I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Football Ramble Mailbag. Radical tactics, what makes a big club, and wonder kids are the order of the day. It's Saturday, 16th of March. I'm Marcus Speller.
I'm Luke Moore.
And I'm Jim Campbell.
Oi, oi, it's Saturday and it feels good, Jim.
It does.
It feels really good.
It's all right for doing a podcast.
Very much so. Now, we are delighted that you've been getting your emails, your messages, your tweets, your comments on the Discord, all that stuff, because that's what makes the show. And if you want to get involved with the mailbag, you can, of course, tweet us on X at Football Ram or message us on Instagram at Football Ram. It's called X.
Yeah, I know. I've got no problem with it.
It's a brilliant rebrand.
I know it was. It's done really, really, really well.
Absolutely right, yeah. And of course, you can email us, show@footballramble.com. But of course, if you really, really want to be considered, if you want to get to the top of the pile with all these messages.
Go around to Marcus's house.
Yeah. And you can find my house on patreon.com/football.
Do a John Cusack outside Marcus's house. No, patreon.com/football is the main bit where all the best people are.
Yeah.
It's worth remembering that at all times.
All of it. Absolutely. Luke, despite that, you've got an email.
Have got an email from Andy, who I hope is a patron. If not, he's got absolutely no business being here. But we're giving the benefit of the doubt for now.
It could be Andy Brassel. We just don't know.
He could be. He asks the following. As a show that famously enjoys the use of an algorithm, think Luke and his penalty shootout formula, has proven over the test of time
that it's sometimes right.
Absolutely spot on. 60% of the time works every time. Alex says, I wanted to ask, what makes a big club, in your guys' opinion? And specifically, what makes one club bigger than the other? Does recent history, for example, make Manchester City bigger than Arsenal? Does entire history make Preston a bigger club than Crystal Palace? Mm. Does having a bigger stadium make Sunderland a bigger club than Fulham? And does being in a higher league make Bournemouth a bigger club than Leeds? Some helpful examples there from Andy. I think know what he's getting at.
Yeah.
This is a question that some of the more one-eyed sections of, say, fan media like to dine out on quite a lot, particularly when they see perhaps nouveau riche clubs coming through and winning things, and they use it as a way to comfort themselves, don't they? Like a Leeds United fan will say, yeah, you've won the treble, Man City, but actually, in the 70s, we did all this stuff, and look at our fan base and all the rest of it. So It's an interesting one to unpick from the point of view of three fairly neutral, old-fashioned gentlemen. Mm. Perhaps here operating in the new media landscape.
In our drawing room.
Yeah. So put up a port and a cigar.
I'm going to jump straight in there. Something that you touched on there is, I think, size of the fan base.
Massively. It's a huge thing.
Yeah. Well, Andy also says, can the algorithm be consulted to ascertain who is the bigger club and put the incessant belly aching on Twitter to rest? I think the short answer to that specific part of the question is no.
Yeah, absolutely.
There is no algorithm. It's
all opinion. Putting belly aching on Twitter to rest.
You should be calling it X first and foremost. Indeed, it's disrespectful to the Musketeer to do that.
He's done for this. Yeah. Rebrand.
Yeah. Well, imagine he was sat up all night thinking about that.
Nothing's going to make Twitter shut the fuck up. Let's be absolutely clear about that.
Not even the Musketeer himself.
Not even rebranding it to X. So there's no algorithm and there's no way we can put it to bed, but it would be interesting to explore our opinions on it. And Marcus, you started off with fan base, which is interesting.
Well, do we want Twitter to shut the fuck up? Because, you know, I think the reason why he rebranded it to X is X marks the banter.
It does.
Yeah. It is possible, though, that the discourse on X will make us dumb down so entirely that we lose sentience altogether.
Yeah.
So perhaps it will shut down.
I've got my fingers crossed, Jim.
But I think to go back to your point, Marcus, about the size of the fan base, I think that in the most fundamental sense of it, that is a huge, huge part of it. Because essentially it comes down to how many people care about what X team, for want of a better phrase, does. Like it's a form of entertainment. It's also a community asset. A football club is a lot of different things at once. How many people's lives are impacted by it is one of the most fundamentally kind of important things about how you kind of measure the size of a club. Like words like size and big don't even necessarily apply. It's quite a nebulous concept, this, isn't it?
Oh, I know people who are massive fans of non-league football, like our mate Chris.
Yeah.
He'll be really genuinely excited and be like, oh, you know, Chesham are away to Fisher Athletic next week, massive club. It's going to be huge. But on the fan base side of it, though, allow me to complicate this a little bit further, because I think fan base is a nice place to start. But what I would say is this, you probably need to be more regionally specific.
You do.
Because
sure,
Manchester City, who I think are a big club, regardless of the nouveau riche element of them, they've, you know, amazing history and everything like that, they will now have a much bigger worldwide fan base than a lot of clubs that perhaps you might think are bigger in England.
Well, I mean, and there's...
So it's not just about that.
There are always examples you can chuck in and go, ah, but this. Mm. That for every single category, you will always be able to find a club.
Yeah.
Who's a bigger club, Nantes or Monaco?
Mm. Yeah.
Well, Monaco have had much, you know, more success, you would say, and we're much more familiar. But, I mean, you know, how often do they still fill their stadium? I mean, Juventus, definitely one of a huge club. Yeah, you can always get tickets for Juventus games because they tell them to sell out the stadium. But, of course, the supportership is far and wide-reaching. Current status is something that people often don't take into account of it.
And, also, I mean, people...
Manchester City
people
are
really
enormous.
Hate that Man City are enormous.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons.
But they're an elite club.
They are an elite club. And also, you can make history at any time, right?
Yeah.
This is the thing. People bring history into it a lot, and that is a huge factor in it as well. But if success is happening now, it doesn't mean it doesn't count. It doesn't mean it doesn't matter for anything.
You can sometimes have too much history. I mean, who's the biggest club on the South Coast?
Come on.
You wouldn't say it was Portsmouth.
I would.
Jim? You wouldn't say it was Portsmouth.
I would probably say it was Southampton.
You would, but Portsmouth have won titles, whereas they're the only club on the South Coast that have won the top flight in England.
If I can answer that in the most neutral way I'm capable of doing it, which probably isn't that neutral, I would say that sometimes it's a confusion that Southampton is a bigger city than Portsmouth, which it is, and Southampton have had more years in the Premier League.
That's where
than
it comes
Portsmouth,
from, for sure.
Which they have.
Yeah.
But by every other measure, they're not a bigger club than Portsmouth.
Southampton have got a better stadium.
It depends what you mean by better. It's slightly bigger.
Yeah, it's definitely...
It's a fucking shithole. It's a proper new...
It's better.
It's a new... But that's a completely subjective viewpoint, because here's what I'm saying.
Right.
You know,
there's no leaks.
Would you say that... I mean, would you... Is Wembley Stadium a better stadium?
The toilet's flush at Southampton.
You don't know what you're talking about, mate. This is the thing. This is what you've got to be. This is why it's impossible to be kind of clear-eyed about it. I when I went to answer this question, I kind of thought about the things that I personally felt were important to ascertain what a big club is and what it isn't. And I think when we were using Man City as that example earlier, I think a better example is probably Chelsea, because their record pre-Abramovich, was pretty poor.
Yeah, FA
pretty,
Cups here and there.
Yeah, pretty.
Well, it wasn't poor. It wasn't what it was when Abramovich took over.
There's a paucity of support and trophies consistently, etc., etc. So a big discrepancy. My touch points for this question were history of trophies and kind of contribution to the overall game, size of fan base, which you guys have covered,
yeah,
amount of things won in total,
yeah,
which I think should be seen as relevant to the size of club they are. So I don't think it's, you can't just say, oh, well, you know, fucking Oxford United never won the Champions League, so they're not a big club. I mean, you have to put it into the milieu. And then the cultural imprint as well, I thought was important.
So the cultural imprint is something that that I was going to say. And to make it sound, you know, and again, look, this is difficult to quantify. Some people think it is easy to quantify because you look at the trophies, you look at maybe size of the stadium, all that kind of stuff. But I think it is the feeling that that club stirs.
Absolutely.
I think if you know, we on yesterday's ramble, we talked about Ajax, and we're like, well, having a bit of a piss poor season, but it's still a glamorous name. Ajax will be a glamorous name for a long time. Say AC Milan. Well, who's a bigger club, AC Milan or Chelsea? Well, Chelsea have had more success in European football in more recently. But AC Milan, you know, and so it depends maybe what...
But AC Milan have won an incredible amount of European Cups.
They have, of course. So it is a tricky one. I mean, Andy mentioned Preston North End, of course, who have won top titles. You know, Fulham have never won a major tournament, major trophy in their histories, I often bang on about. Who's a bigger club there? You know, and so I think current status is also something that few people take into account. We talked about when Forest were down in the Championship and they eventually got promoted. There was a lot of people, especially our age and maybe a little bit older, or definitely a bit older. Oh my goodness, it's nice to have them back because we remember. Some people will not remember. Yeah. They go, who gives a damn if they won the European Cup in the late 70s? There will be a lot of people, who young and old, but definitely young, who won't care.
So this is an interesting point. With Forest in particular, I think, because Forest are a really good example of how you might have parameters of what makes a big club traditionally, but they can be outperformed. In the grand scheme, Forest don't have anywhere near as many supporters as a lot of teams do, but the achievements that they've had has stamped their mark on the very fabric of the game. As you've touched on, I think trophies and what a club wins are essentially their impact that they've had on the game itself.
It's the currency.
And their contribution to the story of the sport.
Which is why I don't think, because it's intrinsic, that what teams have won is intrinsic, and it's the currency that we all enjoy the game in.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the whole point of it for the players and for the managers. And which is why I don't think, conversely, to go back to Andy's question, does having a bigger stadium make Sunderland a bigger club than Fulham? No. Sunderland may well be a bigger club than Fulham.
Well, they've got a bigger stadium than probably Chelsea, don't they?
But it's not the point.
Yeah.
The stadium is irrelevant. I mean, because...
Well, it's not irrelevant.
I think it is, but I'll tell you what, let me explain that. It's if you were really going to look about a factor in this question, which is match-going fans, I think that's fine. I think you can, and you've mentioned that with Juventus as an example, right? Yeah. Whether a wealthy owner built you a stadium or not, it to me is entirely irrelevant.
Well, it can be irrelevant with, say, like the example of Monaco, even though their stadium's quite small, but the fact is they don't fill it. But it can be relevant if you have to build a bigger stadium because an awful lot of people want to watch you because you're a huge club and therefore you've got to expand, and you can expand. Hmm. You know, in our lifetimes, we've seen Old Trafford expand. I mean, people say they should get a bloody new stadium. But Manchester City, again, obviously Arsenal as well, move stadium. Arsenal right now playing in, you know, at Highbury, it would seem too small, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and Chelsea, how, you know, they've been looking, they want to build a stadium on top of Waterloo Station, which anybody listening to this knows what was utterly ridiculous. Oh, or Battersea Power Station, another.
Pompey wanted to do one in the harbour at Portsmouth, which is incredible.
That
was
floating.
That was a piss take. Yeah. They did, they wanted to, yeah.
No, intriguing. So,
strange that didn't happen.
Very strange. Yeah. I couldn't imagine that going on.
Sounded a bit like System of a Down there.
But if we relate stadium and fan, but the reason I'm saying this is because, you know, obviously.
I don't think it's a clinching factor, but I think it depends. So I don't think to say it's irrelevant. But
it's an indication of how many people care, right? It comes back into the size of the fan.
So look at Newcastle United and Sunderland and a lot of those teams up in the northeast that fill their stadium wherever they are. I mean, to be fair to Man City, they took a lot of fans when they were down the third tier. Leeds United's another good example.
Another one.
The reason, I know you're being kind of slightly mischievous when you're talking about Southampton, but if you look at Southampton's attendances when they dropped out the Premier League, they're far lower than Portsmouth in League One.
So there is that.
But you've got to factor it all in.
You do, but you mentioned the word regional earlier. You know, we talk about Premier League clubs, we talk about all this in big clubs. Rangers and Celtic are bigger than most English clubs.
Agree.
And I don't think anybody would disagree with that, really. But you don't think about it because they play in a league which is inferior to the Premier League.
Yeah, totally.
But that's why if Rangers and Celtic moved into the Premier League, which I don't think should happen, and that was a chat from years ago, you know, that would have been interesting to see what would have happened there.
But Celtic are a great example, Marcus, because...
Yeah. And they have won the European
Cup. It's about cultural imprint.
Yep.
It's about them being the first British team to win the European
Cup. That's right, yeah.
In, was it 67, I think? Is that right? I think it was.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was 67. Yeah. Man United won it the year after.
Yeah. And the size of fan base, obviously huge, because culturally they have a very strict, like quite a very kind of prominent identity.
Yeah.
And
everyone in Europe will be familiar with.
So they tick all those boxes. The four kind of quite arbitrary categories that I came up with when I was thinking about this was, like I said, history of trophies. So they've got that, contribution to the game, size of fan base, huge, cultural imprint, very, very big, and amount of things well in total. Again, partly because they're in a slightly inferior league, of course, but that's also part of it. So I think you also go, if you go to, I wonder if you go to South America, for example, and you speak to someone who's, you know, about, you know, maybe our parents' age or whatever, and ask them about Celtic, they know who they are. They would.
Well, I thought so.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying.
In Nigeria, they know, or Lagos, certainly, they know who Dundee United are, quite
obviously. Of course.
It's an insult in Lagos.
I know it is. Exactly.
Do your own research, everybody. Yeah, it's true.
I think so. How much do we think history and sort of legacy comes into it, in a sense? Because one of the great things about football is that the clubs we support were there for a long, long time before us and will be there for a long, long time after us as well. And
unless it's RB Leipzig, Jim.
Unless it's RB Leipzig, yeah. But, you do have unfortunate cases where clubs go out of business, of course. But I think the weight of those past achievements does matter, because traditions are kind of passed along through generations in songs in the grounds and things like that. But I think the past glories that teams have had, it sets the tone of the club, the standards of the club, what can be achieved. And it's also, it's kind of the standard that each new player aspires to, you know, and that history, as we've touched on, can be made at any time. But at some clubs, the expectation is different from others, and that comes from the history, and that again informs the size of the club.
You're right, but that history does sometimes, you know, and it's a ridiculous thing to say, but it does, in terms of its impact, it does have a sell-by date, or it does fade.
Absolutely,
of course. Torino, for example.
Blackburn Rovers won loads of stuff in the 19th
much
century.
Much more contemporary, I was going to go for Provocelli next.
Yeah.
So there is all that. I think in terms of arguing who's a bigger club, Arsenal or Man City and all the rest of it,
That's for YouTubers.
A lot of it down to your own sort of interpretation and feeling and all that kind of stuff as well.
A friend of mine once asked me if Arcade Fire were bigger than Arsenal, and I don't know how to answer that.
I like where he's going with that question, but I don't think they are.
I don't think they could sell out 60,000 every week.
A Man City bigger than Hula Hoops? Next question.
Not for me.
Hula Hoops aren't as big as they were, are they?
Yeah, next question.
Sorry, the next question.
I hope Andy feels like we've kind of explored that at least. It's impossible to answer, of course. And most mailbag shows of this type wouldn't go in for those kind of questions because they're impossible to answer. Mm. But we'll give it a good discussion.
We have.
We will. We'll try and knock up an algorithm and then not share it with you.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This episode of the Football Ramble is sponsored by BetterHelp. Life throws many different challenges at us, and as a result, we all have our own sources of stress. Whether big or small, those stresses can impact our lives in unpredictable ways, and if we don't address them, they can have an outsized and unwanted impact. Therapy is a safe place in which we can address these issues, learn to understand them, and find ways to work through them. Having therapy can be beneficial to anybody, not just people who've experienced major traumas, even if you may have not considered it before. It could be simply a time for you to get things off your chest, a way to learn positive coping skills, or how to set boundaries. Ultimately, it can be whatever you need it to be. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire and BetterHelp will match you to a licensed therapist. You can even switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Alex has been on touch on X and asks, if you were a manager, are there any radical tactics you would employ to psych out your opponent within the laws of the game, of course? I'm convinced that keeping four players on the halfway line when defending corners and using no wall when defending a direct free kick would both work. Now, interestingly, goalkeepers stopped using walls against Janino Panambacao, didn't they? Because he was...
Panambacao, of course.
Because he was such a good free kick taker that the wall was just getting in the line of sight. But that is a slightly unique...
So I wanted to explore one of Alex's suggestions, and it was indeed that wall thing.
I want to explore the other one, but go on.
You can go on that. Yeah. I mean, I genuinely think beyond a certain distance, it's less beneficial to have a wall there.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is, I think if you're fortunate enough to go and watch a game in person, and there's a top goalkeeper there, the one that always sticks in my mind is Alisson. You see Alisson play in the flesh. His presence is unbelievable. Mm. But it is like something, even if you've played football to a fairly decent kind of amateur level, you will have never experienced goalkeeping at the level anywhere near what Alisson is capable of in terms of athletic ability, technique, presence, charisma, leadership, all that kind of stuff. It's a completely different world. And I remember seeing Alisson play in the flesh, I forget who it was against now, but I was quite near the goal. I'll tell you, it was. I think it might have been when I was at Craven Cottage watching them when they threw with Liverpool at the end of the season. Yeah. And I just remember thinking, you are going to, I mean, I'm talking about maybe a free kick, direct free kick, maybe 28 to 30 yards out.
It's quite far.
I think it's going to need to be something very special indeed to get past Alisson, and I don't think a wall makes a scrap of difference because you're far enough out to get it over the wall and down again. That's really the challenge. For those people who don't really know much about that kind of thing, the closer in you get, the harder it is to get it up and down over the wall.
Yeah.
You have to put enough whip and enough elevation to get it up over the guys who jump and then down again. And the closer you're in, it's harder to do that. The further out, it's easier to do that. I don't think the wall becomes that much of a problem when you're further out. Mm. I just think what it does is it gives a goalkeeper like Alisson less chance to see it.
But this is
which is in a disadvantage to him. So I think Alex is spot on. Well,
it is a tactic that or a thing to do which has been discussed by this before. I think the four players on the halfway line is more radical because I've never seen it, and
I don't think there's any benefit to that at all.
Well,
what's the benefit?
Well, because you can obviously break, and do they leave? More players back then, so they have...
So it becomes a bit of a game of bluff.
Yeah. It does a bit, yeah, because of course, well, they've got fewer attackers in the box, but you've got fewer defending players in the box. You know, I would have thought that it wouldn't work ultimately because an attacking team, I think if there's fewer players in the box for a corner, that benefits the attacking team.
Too much, yeah.
Yeah, you want to make it congested so people can't run. And
I think it works, thinking about it, because if you leave four players...
Depends who you've got, though. If you've got defenders who are towering over everybody and win every header...
But the reason that goalkeepers don't claim as much... is because the penalty area is so crowded.
Yeah, there is that.
So if you take four out and then the other team call your bluff and go out there with you, you've got eight fewer players in the penalty area, which means the goalkeeper can basically claim a lot more than they currently do.
The goalkeeper then can distribute and get them going.
And also, you would presumably the attacking team would probably just play short. And then you've got four players busting a gut to get back. You potentially have a lot of gaps opening up there. It's interesting.
But if you were attacking... And so the opposition have got four and a half on, and you could just go, brilliant, we've got more attackers in the box of corners. Sure. So it could fall foul.
It's also worth remembering, guys, that a very, very small percentage of corners result in a goal anyway.
That is true, yeah.
It's like I think it's a handful of percent, no more than that.
In terms of radical tactics, there's not too much that I could think of myself that Pep Guardiola hasn't already done.
Sure.
You know, five up front across the...
He learned a lot of that from you to start with, though, didn't he?
So I'd like to think so, Jim. I'd like to think so. But I mean, is there any radical tactics that anybody else thought?
Radical is maybe not what I would how I would describe it, but quite often you see, you know, and as we always have in football, players get wound up by the antics of the opposition and, mm-hmm. and things they're saying to them and like shirt pulls and things that are very, very clearly designed to mm-hmm. wind players up. I would try to instill in my players that you just ignore everything the opposition do. Just
Sol
completely ignore
apparently.
Them like they're not there. Yeah, just be completely blank and sort of quite robotic. Act like they're not even there. I think at first it would look a bit superior and a bit arrogant and that might wind people up. By the end of the game, it would seem psychotic, Jim, and it might actually be frightening.
I completely agree with you. That was always my thing whenever I played. Just ignore, because the opposition they hate it.
Well, it's wasted energy as well. Isn't
completely,
it?
Yeah. And that's what I've mentioned this before in the pod. But that's what Ian Wright used to say about Sol Campbell, because he would be in the ears of defenders, and he loved a bit of the chat, of course. But he said Sol Campbell was one. He was just like a brick wall. Just didn't even get any reaction from it. And he said, and it would wind him up. Mm. Ian Wright said, you know, and so I think that's a
so I would add that I think we recorded the show yesterday where Liverpool blitzed Sparta Prague 11-2 on aggregate, and the discrepancy between the haves and the have-nots in football is you know, big and getting bigger. I don't think we're that far away from a situation where, for example, Manchester City are playing an unfancied team in a knockout stage of the Champions League. Uh-huh. Or say they have a disaster in the Champions League and they end up going to the Europa, right? Yeah. And they're playing the quarterfinal against someone, you know, average.
They're playing FC Copenhagen.
Or Karabag or someone like that, right? And in the second leg, they haven't been able to break through or whatever, and it's 0-0 in aggregate and there's 10 minutes left. I don't think it's a huge stretch to say that Guardiola might take the goalkeeper off and bring another player out.
Can you do that?
I don't know, but if you can, I think he would like to do it. because it sounds mad, but if you look at the numbers, there will be periods of time across, because Premier League do this stats all the time when you're watching the broadcast, 5 minutes, last 5 minutes possession.
Yeah.
Sometimes Man City is 95,
you 96. You don't actually need to take the goalkeeper off. Yeah. They always talk about Edison. Just like get him involved into midfield.
But he's already doing that.
No, not to the extent that you're talking
not
about.
Not in the way an outfield player would. And people, as you say, people often say about Edison, he's so good he could play in midfield. And we don't know that,
I don't think that's true,
we know he's excellent with his feet.
I think that tactic...
Not for Man City.
If I may try and actually add some sort of seriousness to it, if you did have Edison, if Manchester City...
Just there to recycle passes, right?
There.
Nothing complicated.
Exactly. So if you are, as the good teams do, like to squeeze the player, basically play in the opposition half... If you add another player,
exactly, it's massive.
You're basically asking them to score from like 70 or 80 yards. They're not getting the ball, exactly,
and they won't have the time to do that anyway.
Yeah, my suggestion is quite radical. It's been done before, not for many, many years, for obvious reasons. But one of the dads who used to come and play, watch us play, always wanted to do what he called the Scunthorpe Rush. Now I mentioned this many years ago on the Ramble, and he reckons Scunthorpe did it. But a team who did do it was Scotland. Reading the 1978 How a Country Lost the World Cup book, which is a really good read, under Ali McLeod, who was very charismatic and he was mad. But he got them all going for a bit. And they did, I think it was against Czechoslovakia in a qualifier. So he tried to do this. They all rushed him.
Explain to what people what it actually is.
It's you take kickoff and you launch the ball into one of the channels, basically at one of their fullbacks, and you've got everybody lined up on the halfway line and you just pile in. You just rush them. And apparently, according to one of the dads, as I say, who came to watch us play, because his son used to play, obviously, Scunthorpe did this in an FA Cup tie and it panicked. He reckoned it was against Liverpool. Now, I'm not sure that was true, but anyway, it panicked the fullback to go out and loses the ball and you're all already there. You've got everyone there and they scored.
So you could... So that isn't as...
Well, let me tell you what happened to Scotland, because they tried to do that and the Czech, or whoever it was a Czech fullback, just looked at it and was like, what? Knocked the ball over the top and Czechoslovakia hit the post. They nearly scored from it because it's so easy to defend against, of course.
Well, I think if you were a team who was decent, better than the other team, and you were somehow in like a cup game,
it's
as you
the
said,
ultimate press.
You found yourself like a goal down,
and
you needed to do something in the last minute. I mean, it wouldn't be the worst idea in the world.
Yeah, but you've essentially given the ball away. So nowadays,
not if you absolutely hammer it and they're not expecting it.
You got some really quick players.
It is really a really weird bastardization of the press. Yeah. Is basically what it
Killian,
is.
Killian, get yourself up there, son.
Hit the channel.
If you've got someone who can kick it kick it high enough, essentially, to buy you the time.
Like a rugby up and under.
Exactly. The up and under is exactly right. You've got to be... You got to find a way to get it up high and get it coming down in a particular place.
You're on board, Jim.
Yeah,
yeah, I like that, Jim.
You're on board.
Love to see Arsenal do that in the title clincher at the end of the season. All or nothing.
Beautiful. Write this from Tarek on email. It says, watching Barcelona take on Napoli this week, I was blown away by their new young defender, Kubasi, who turned 17, yes, 17 in January, but was named player of the match. I would like to hear from you guys. When was a time that a young player really took you aback and made you think, this guy's going to be a world beater? I'm even more interested to hear about the ones that didn't make it. Good question.
Very good.
I mean, the obvious couple that did, Michael Owen and Wayne Rooney. Mm.
I remember Rooney's goal because it was against Arsenal.
Exactly. And then obviously...
Owen against Wimbledon it was.
Yeah.
Away from
they were both... That was a good example of players who had just come in from nowhere. I think with Rooney, I remember hearing a couple of rumours, but obviously the world wasn't as connected as it is now. But I do remember people talking about him.
I remember Robbie Fowler bursting onto the scene.
And it was like they hadn't had to make any kind of leap into first team football at all at the very top level. I mean, Wayne Rooney said himself, didn't he? All the players he thought were his heroes at Everton, he started training with them and he thought they were rubbish.
Yeah.
These are crap.
Yeah. Michael Owen was just really looking back on it, was just pure pace and finishing, really. He gets a lot of credit for his pace, Owen, but he was a good finisher as well, of course. Mm. And they did really do it. I mean, Rooney in Euro 2004, Michael Owen's apotheosis would have been.
Have you got any?
World Cup, not yet, against Argentina. I've got one. Everyone knows about those. I've got one that didn't make it. A bunch of us used to go to Fratton Park every week, and there was a player back then, would have been about 20 plus, well, definitely 20 plus years ago now.
Peter Crouch?
No, it wasn't him. There's a player called Lewis Buxton.
Bucko.
Who was a centre-back for Portsmouth, and he made his debut at 17, and he was a man grown. He was under Graham Ricks at the time, so that'll date it. For those of you out there who know when Graham Ricks managed Pompey, I can't remember, just before Harry Redknapp. And he looked amazing. He was brilliant. He was like Barassi. It was unbelievable. And people were genuinely excited. Like, Pompey didn't really produce that many players then. And it was like, this guy's got it. Like, he's going to be amazing. And we couldn't believe he was 17. Harry Redknapp came in, didn't like him, put him out on loan to Bournemouth. How times change. And he helped Bournemouth win the league, whatever league they're in now, but it was one below Portsmouth, I think. And then he ended up having quite a good career at Sheffield Wednesday and in the lower leagues. And he didn't disgrace himself at all. He had a very good professional career. But he looked like the player that you were going to go, wow, he could go for big money to a Premier League club, you know? But it never quite happened for him. But he was a very, very good player to watch.
Yeah, I remember when I first saw David Beckham, and it was when they got beat 3-0 by Aston Villa. Now, he'd had a few appearances for Manchester United by this time. I hadn't really clocked him. But he scored the only Manchester United goal that game.
Yeah. Part of the Beckham myth, sorry to cut you, Marcus, but part of the Beckham myth is that the first time anyone noticed him was when he scored from the halfway line against Wimbledon. That's not true, is it?
No, there was
a lot before that.
That got him to cross over into non-football fan circles, basically.
Exactly, yeah. But the goal that he scored against Aston Villa, it was a consolation, but it was an absolute pinger.
And from distance?
It was from distance, yeah. And it really stood out for a few friends of mine and I for some reason.
I remember the one you mean.
Yeah, and we would sort of we would often talk about, oh yeah, Beckham, what a right foot he had, and like if you scored a long range of yourself, I was a bit of a Beckham and all that. And this was, you know, way before, so obviously, you know, he would go on to do what he would do. I have a couple of ones though, ones that didn't make it. Spurs fans may remember Dean Marnie.
Yes. Yeah.
Dean Marnie, when he played early on in his career, now he'd probably been about 20 at the time, he played for Spurs and he scored an absolute peach. I forget.
Busy midfielder.
Was it against Everton maybe?
A long ranger.
Yeah.
Looping.
And he looked amazing.
It sounds like a knockoff Wayne Rooney, doesn't it?
Yeah, Dean Marnie. And I remember at that point going, oh my God, look at the way he's taken that goal, the technique, everything. He's going to be brilliant. Now, he had a very respectable career, Hull City and Burnley, I think it was, but didn't quite go on. And then a Fulham one would be Kerim Fry, who was a tricky winger, very quick. And when he was playing, I remember Rio Ferdinand once tweeting when Fry came on in a game, going, wow, this Fry guy, he looks an absolute player. He was so quick, so exciting. It just didn't really happen. Yeah. Didn't really happen.
I think there are a few of those that that I remember, some of which show me that I was quite idealistic and just happy to be excited for a bit of tricky footwork. I really thought Wayne Routledge might go on to be something quite special. Yeah. Just because when he was, career, when he was young, he did have a good career. Michael Johnson would be another one at Man City.
Who obviously
retired for very sad reasons. But when he first kind of broke through, this was, if I remember rightly, was in the sort of the Gerard Lampard era. And I thought, this is something really different from a midfield player that England might call on in the future, because he looked like he was a real, real talent. And I think...
He's an estate agent now, isn't he?
Possibly.
That was certainly the rumour, yeah.
This may be... I may slightly be bending the parameters of the question here, but I really thought Yohan Gourcuff was going to go on to be a genuine superstar. Like, as many people said at the time, the Zidane of his generation, a player with such incredible footwork, such silk. Uh-huh. And I thought, we are watching one of the next, like, box office best players in the world
He looked good as well, didn't he? He looked good.
He looked fantastic, yeah. I mean, like, I understand you've obviously put the caveat in there, but yeah, you're right. But he did have some moments, though.
Sure, yeah. I mean, all of these players have had good careers.
True. We're going to finish with a question from Ashley on X, which says, which England player do you boys wish had more caps for England? I know who you're going to say.
Michael Carrick.
Yeah, I knew you'd say Carrick. Yeah. That's a fair shout.
Steve Bruce, no caps for England.
Do you know what?
Very good.
19 goals in one season.
Yeah.
So
and so much success. So many trophy wins.
He was a brilliant player.
So basically, Graham Taylor didn't really rate him, did he? And I found some quotes about that. So in 1987... Bobby Robson told Graham Taylor, who was his assistant at the time, to give Steve Bruce the captaincy for an England B international against Malta. High stakes. So Taylor did it really reluctantly, and Steve Bruce said that he said to him, you're captain, by the way, but it's not my choice, it's Bobby. For me, you'd never be captain.
What?
Yeah.
Poor Graham Taylor's a good guy, isn't he? Yeah, why are you saying that?
I know. Terry Venables did offer him a cap. But Bruce knew that it was because Brian Robson was his assistant, and it was like a sympathy thing at 35. And with a lot of dignity, said he'd rather not have a cap than have a sympathy one at the tail end of his career.
Yeah.
Shame Joe Barton didn't do the same.
But you are, that's a good mention of Steve Bruce. Incredible that he didn't have an England
one name answer for you, Marcus.
Owen Hargreaves.
Yeah, fair.
Because I think at that
injuries.
Time, and probably why you picked Carrick as well,
yeah.
That he was the man who should have been playing in the centre midfield beside one of those guys.
Yeah, whose name we shall not mention. It's Voldemort.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much for listening to the Football Ramble Mailbag, part of the Acast Creator Network. We're back on Monday with a brand new Ramble. In the meantime, follow us on X, TikTok, YouTube and Instagram at Football Ramble, and follow us on Spotify as well.
Don't forget to become a member of our Patreon and our Discord and all that good stuff too for just $5 a month. patreon.com/footballramble. You can join the biggest, fastest, most energetic, exciting, growing bunch of football fans anywhere on the internet. And I'm in the Discord as well, so don't let that put you off.
What more do you want?
patreon.com/footballramble for really roughly the price of one cup of coffee in, I'd say, $5, Jim? Yeah, about right.
I can say.
Why not?
Yeah.
See you soon, everybody.
The Football Ramble is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay. And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.